Hello, everyone, and welcome to episode 22 of True Crime All the Time. I'm Mike Ferguson, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Mike Gibson. Gibby, how are you today?
Hey, man, I'm doing good.
That's good to hear, man.
Yeah, it's a good, nice Friday evening.
Well, it's nice out, too. It's not raining. It's been raining for, like, ever, it seems.
Last 2 days, I think my backyard's a pond now, so I'm glad to see the rain stop. I'm glad it's warming up again.
And we're in studio.
We're in the studio.
Which is always good.
Yep.
We got a bunch of new Patreon supporters.
We do.
Which is awesome.
Like that.
So let's give some shout outs to Steven Schnell, Jordan Frakes, Marina Frieden, Larissa Wilson, and Jackie Curtis.
Wow. Like
love
that.
It. Yeah. Love
thank
it.
You.
Thank you, everyone. Appreciate it so much. So got the stickers in. The stickers are up on the website and been mailing out stickers to our Patreon supporters. Everyone check out our website, truecrimeallthetime.com. Click on that merchandise tab. It'll take you right to our shop. You know, also check out the information page. That's where you get our voicemail line. And we got a voicemail tonight, Gibbs.
Oh, we do?
Yep. I'm going to play.
That's cool.
And it's actually an update on the past case. It's pretty exciting.
Oh, I like that.
You get our email, Twitter, Facebook. Everything's out there. And I know a lot of people are taking advantage of that because we get a lot of emails. And, you know, our Facebook page is growing. Twitter, Instagram. We love all that stuff.
Oh, I do.
Getting a lot of case suggestions.
We do.
And actually, the case that we're doing tonight, Robert Picton, you know, we're going outside the U.S.
Yeah.
For the very first time. But this was a case that was highly suggested.
It's a good one.
It is. It really is a good one. So if you want to support us on Patreon, you can do that by going to patreon.com/truecrimeallthetime. Hey folks, if you haven't tried Audible yet, what are you waiting on? You've heard me talk about it for a while now. Audible offers an incredible selection of audiobooks across every genre, from bestsellers to mysteries and thrillers, true crime and more. Audible is the home of storytelling. You'll discover thousands of podcasts from popular favorites to exclusive new series. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. But members also get full access to a growing selection of included audiobooks, Audible originals, and podcasts, and you can download or stream those included titles all you want. And the Audible app is great. Makes it very easy to listen anytime, anywhere, whether you're traveling, working out, walking the dog, or just doing your chores. Right now, I'm listening to a thriller titled Then She Was Gone by Lisa Jewell. It's absolutely amazing. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/TCAT or text TCAT to 500-500. That's audible.com/TCATT or text TCAT to 500-500. All right, Gibbs. So like we mentioned, we're going outside the U.S., Canadian case.
Yes.
And we're pairing it with our other podcast, True Crime All the Time Unsolved, where we're also doing a Canadian case.
Yeah, up in Toronto.
Very, very interesting case on that episode as well. We'll be dropping at the very same time. And that's Christine Jessup.
Interesting twist, though.
Yeah, I think that's the key to that one. It's an unsolved solve slash unsolved.
Yeah.
Is the best way to describe it. But on this episode, we're talking about the infamous Robert Picton. And Robert Picton is Canada's most prolific, probably most notorious serial killer.
I mean, really, he could be in that category for all North America.
Yeah, you're right. I said Canada, but when you look at what this guy did, you can put him at the top of the list or near the top of the list of a lot of crazy serial killers.
Absolutely.
There's no doubt about that. Especially, you know, when you talk about number and you talk about some of the crazy aspects to the case.
This is a pretty sick one.
So Picton operated between the years of 1983 and 2002. And again, we talked about his number of victims. It's anywhere probably as high as 49. I think he's admits 49, probably even higher.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah, it could be as high as what?
60, 70?
70, yeah.
But I think 49 is a pretty safe bet, just based on the information that comes out.
Right.
Now, the crazy thing about Picton is that he was a pig farmer, and he used this pig farm to his advantage in disposing of his victims. So because of that, he has, we say this every time, he's got a bunch of nicknames.
He does. He's got the name of the pig farmer killer, the pig-headed killer, and our favorite, Pork Chop Rob.
Pork Chop Rob.
Yeah.
Kind of like Pork Chop Rob. All right, so before we get into the background on Robert Picton, I just want to play this voicemail that we got.
Hi, Mike and Gibby. This is Kelly, and I'm in Oklahoma City. And I recently discovered your podcast and quickly went through all the episodes at work. I just wanted to call and give you guys an update on the Alton Nolan case. On Monday, April 3rd, he made his second appearance for his competency hearing, in which 35 minutes in, he had to be subdued on the floor by three sheriff's deputies because he would not sit down after he bolted upright from his chair. I honestly don't know what he was thinking based on the fact that he's in belly chains. Where do you think he was going? According to court records, this is the latest in a string of aggressive incidents. He has allegedly threatened and attacked guards in the jail and told them they know why he's there and he will do the same thing to them. Ruling is actually expected today, Thursday, April 6th, and the judge will proceed to sentencing if she deems him mentally competent and he stands by his plea. So hopefully I can give you guys a call back within the next few days with her ruling and what she had to say about the whole case.
All right, so we love voicemails.
Absolutely.
And this is the first one we've had with an update on a case, which is awesome.
Yeah.
A case that we've done. You know, Alton Nolan, crazy beheading workplace story.
Yeah, that was a crazy story.
It was. And then, you know, and then on top of that, we had Donald Harvey, who, you know, we did not that long ago.
Right.
Who got beat up in his cell and killed, which was kind of a crazy coincidence as well. So thanks to Kelly for that voicemail. We love voicemails. Everybody send us one. We'll pick some that we like and we'll play them on the air or on the podcast. We're not really on air. I'm walking on air. All right, we got to get into Robert Picton. There's a lot here, Gibbs.
Pork Chop Rob.
So let's get into background. You know, Robert Picton, he's born in Port Coquitlam, and that's British Columbia, on October 24th, 1949. Now, in 63, his parents buy 40 acres of swampland for $18,000. They take their farmhouse and tow it and move it onto this 40-acre plot that they buy, and they begin raising both children and pigs. There again, this is how Pork Chop Rob gets into the pig farming business.
Yeah.
Now, they've got two sons, Robert and David, and one daughter named Linda. Now, the kids were described as constantly filthy, which to me doesn't seem all that out of the ordinary in 1960 if you're on a pig farm.
Yeah, but I think they went to school.
I think it was to the extreme.
Yeah.
You know, it was said that they just smelled all the time.
I think they rolled out of bed and their clothes they had on the day before and just went off to school.
Had, you know, pig shit all over it or whatever. But because of this, you know, Robert didn't fit in. You know, nobody likes the smelly kid. Don't be the smelly kid in class.
She really was a tyrant. She ran the roost. The kids worked very, very hard. And she had this distinctive voice. She'd shout at the kids and say, "You kids get over here right now." And she'd screech at them. The Picton children were famous for stinking of manure and of pigs and unwashed clothing and unwashed bodies. When they got on the school bus in the morning, children didn't want to sit near them, and they called them Stinky Piggy.
We forgot that nickname.
Stinky Piggy?
Yeah.
So you hear the woman talk a little bit about Robert's mom. And she, as in a lot of these cases that we talk about, she's a central figure in kind of shaping what he becomes. Now, at the age of 12, something pretty significant happens in Robert's life. So he's got this pet calf that he's very, very attached to. Now, this is a departure.
Yeah, it is.
Because a lot of times we're talking about these serial killers who are hurting animals, going out of their way to be mean to all dogs and cats and this. Now, here you've got Robert Picton with a pet calf. He's taking care of it. He's loving on it. It might be his only friend at this point.
Well, I think it's giving him unconditional love back, you know, like a dog would.
Which he's probably not getting
anywhere else.
Anywhere else.
He's not getting it from mom.
No. And, you know, his mom was something else.
Right.
I don't know how else to say it, but some of it comes out later in the story. Suffice to say, he cared very deeply for this calf. And one day he comes home to find out that his dad had slaughtered the calf. What kind of father figure are we talking about as well? What kind of lessons is he learning from his mom and dad? His dad knew that he loved this calf, and he goes out of his way to slaughter it. What type of blow does that cause to a 12-year-old psyche?
Yeah, I mean, it's got to do some damage for sure. But, I mean, it's life on the farm. Typically, you'd wait till the calf is a cow and, you know, has put on enough weight. So the kill it that early, they were trying to set example of don't get attached to the animals. But, man, what kind of damage did that do to him?
So that incident had to affect him, right? No doubt about that. But now something else happens in his childhood that's even bigger and would have had to have had even a bigger effect on Robert. So on the evening of October 16th, 1967, now his brother Dave at this point is 16 and can drive. Dave takes their dad's truck from the farm and he's driving along the road. It's about 8 o'clock at night. Just ahead of him on the right side of the road is one of the neighborhood kids. This is a 14-year-old boy who's walking down the road. It gets a little fuzzy because there's really no details on exactly how it happens, but he slams right into this kid from behind driving down the road. Now, Dave knows right away that this kid is hurt bad, and he panics and he drives home. He does the right thing. He drives home. He tells mom what he did. You know, I hit this kid on the side of the road. Their mom immediately stops what she's doing. And she drives over to where the kid was laying. She takes a look at the boy. And then what she does, Gibbs, is she leans down and she shoves him into like a drainage ditch.
Full of water.
Full of water. And then she just turns around and goes home.
Knowing that he was breathing.
Yeah, he was alive.
Yeah, he was alive when she pushed him.
Which is a good point. She knew he was alive. And she throws him into the water and leaves. So obviously this boy's parents, they're going nuts, right? Trying to find him. They're calling neighbors. And this is early morning because the boy never comes home. And they eventually go to the police station, report their son missing. The next morning, neighbors are out trying to help them find their son. And somebody spots one of his shoes on the side of the road. They look around into the drainage ditch, and that's where they see the boy's body. Police are called. They come. They take the boy out. And this is where I think it's crazy, because the autopsy shows the cause of death is drowning. And that's kind of what we were getting at when we said he was still breathing. She knew he was still breathing. Now, he had major injuries. He had a fractured skull and a dislocated pelvis. But it was thought by the pathologist that those injuries alone would not have killed him.
And there's no way she would have known. I mean, if she thought she was doing him a favor by doing what she did, I mean, it'd be a weird favor. But well, if she thought she's putting him, because she's used to working with all these animals. And
So you're thinking putting him out of his misery.
Putting him down.
Like you would an animal.
Absolutely.
Well, I don't know that her thought process was very far from that.
It might not have been. She might have thought, you know, he's suffering. He's not going to make this. I'm going to go ahead and put him down. Let me just roll him into this ditch, just as she would treat any animal. Because we knew they didn't treat their animals that great.
Now, the mom was never charged with anything. But by all accounts, the real story got out among the neighbors. And they knew what had happened. And I think the police knew too at some point. To what degree, I don't know, but I think they knew that the Pictons were somehow involved. So early life for Robert Picton was a little crazy, to say the least. Now, his mom and dad both die pretty close together. His dad dies in 78, his mom dies in 79. And what that does is it leaves the farm to the three kids. So Robert, Dave, and Linda all inherit the farm.
The 40-acre swampland?
Yeah, I'm calling it a farm. You know, we say swampland, and in the 60s it was. But something happens in the subsequent years in Port Coquitlam is that it starts to develop. And so what happens is that this swampland, farmland, whatever you want to call it, that the parents bought in 63 for $18,000, by 1994, it's worth $7.2 million.
That's a good investment.
Right. So ultimately, what we're going to have here, Gibbs, is what I'm thinking is kind of a Clampett's meets Silence of the Lambs.
Oh, yeah.
Because how many stories do we have where, because Robert Picton becomes a millionaire because of this, right? So they sell off parts of the farm to several different entities. I think at one point they make $1.7 million for part of it. And then they sell another part off to somebody else for like 1.2. And then the school district, the Port Coquitlam school district, buys a piece for 2.3.
Right. There's some good cash coming in.
So even splitting it, I don't know how they split it up, but even splitting it three ways, they're all millionaires. So how many serial killers do we talk about that are just straight up millionaires? Now, he's also a pig farmer with manure all over him.
And he didn't elevate his lifestyle.
No, he's still living like a poor,
still has his
pig farmer.
Yeah. You know, he didn't build a house or anything like that. Just kept his trailer.
But the same can't be said for his brother, because his brother David leaves the family farm, just moves down the road a piece, and he builds a new place. And on that property where he built the house, he also builds what is termed a party hall with a very interesting name of Piggy's Palace.
Piggy's Palace.
I'm thinking of Porky's.
That's what I was just thinking.
I'm thinking of the, what was that place they went to in Porky's where the sign lit up?
Somebody will let us know.
I think it was called Porky's. That's the name of the movie.
That's the name of the movie. That's right.
They went to Porky's. That was the whole point of the movie.
That was the whole point of, I get it now. That was a great movie.
So we got to talk about this Piggy's Palace, because I don't know what the heck this place was, but it was almost like a bar / den of debauchery. I mean, it's got a lot going on. You know, one person that was interviewed later on said, you know, it was just a lot of motorcycles, old cars. They had always had a pig roasting on a spit. Then they talked about having kids in costumes running around, little kids running around playing in the dark. lots of women, lots of prostitutes. It was said, you know, we're running around this place all the time. But Picky's Palace was not all that it was cracked up to be. It was designed when they first started it to be a nonprofit society dedicated to raising money for sports organizations.
Oh, so like a tax shelter.
I think that's what it was.
Yeah.
When you really boil it down. You know, really, Piggy's Palace was nothing but a tin shed. But the funny part about it, it was said that, you know, it wasn't just like the bad element or biker gangs or something that visited. I mean, everybody in the town was said to have visited Piggy's Palace. I mean, we're talking about mayors,
teachers,
city council members, business leaders. It even said something about, I don't know, soccer moms or hockey, probably in Canada it was hockey moms.
Yeah.
You mentioned teachers, but then it also said a lot of students, right? Because you got a lot of kids running around. So you got prostitutes, kids, teachers, business owners, local leader. I mean, it just seems like it's a crazy scenario.
It was the place where everybody knew your name.
Norm. So what was said to have happened at Piggy's Palace? Functions, dances, concerts.
Wow.
And other recreational activities.
What's the other?
I think that's what it was. I think it was less functions, dances, and concerts, a lot more recreational activities.
I think that's was true.
But the key here is that David has moved. Now, what we didn't mention is Linda does not live on the farm. She lives in the city.
Smart.
And she ultimately gets married, and she's not a part of this story really at all. So Robert is left by himself on the pig farm. He's got tons of money, and now he's got complete freedom, right? He's got nobody looking over his shoulder. His parents are gone. His brother's at least down the road. Now, I want to talk a little bit about Robert, how neighbors described him. They described him as slow. And I think you'll see that a lot in the research. You know, I don't believe that Robert, I think he had a very low IQ. It was also said that he did not drink, he didn't smoke, and a lot of people thought he was a nice guy.
Which, you know, they say that a lot about serial killers, right? I mean, they can be really nice and sweet to certain people, but on the flip end, and they, once that switch goes, they can just be the ruthless.
Well, I think, and you and I have talked about this some, but a lot of serial killers are the consummate con artists, right? So to be able to get away with what they're doing and to cover it up and to have people not suspect them, that takes a lot of, I guess, skill. I guess that's what you'd call it.
Yeah, I agree.
But there's a lot of con artistry going on with these people where, you know, they're a family man one minute and the next minute they're chopping people up and doing all kinds of crazy things, and they can flip back and forth. You know, that's a big part of it.
Yeah, that's probably the hard thing to understand for me.
Right. Now, Robert Picton was no family man, so he doesn't have to flip back and forth. It just said that, you know, his neighbors described him as nice. You know, springtime is all about fresh air, fresh starts, and freshly cleaned homes. And it's the perfect time to give a fresh look at SimpliSafe Home Security, the only home security system I use and recommend. Springtime also means more time outside and away from home. And I trust SimpliSafe. I love the myriad of features that they offer. And I love the price. SimpliSafe was named Best Home Security Systems for 2024 by U.S. News & World Report. The system blankets your whole home in protection. detection. There are so many sensors, from detecting break-ins, fires, floods, and more. Plus, they have a variety of indoor and outdoor cameras to keep watch over your property day and night. It's backed by 24/7 professional monitoring for less than $1 a day. So you get fast emergency response and dispatch when you need it most. There's no contract, and they have a 60-day money-back guarantee. So you can try SimpliSafe risk-free. Don't absolutely love it? Send the system back for a full refund. SimpliSafe has given Gibby and I and many of our listeners real peace of mind. We want you to have it too. Get 20% off any new SimpliSafe system when you sign up for Fast Protect monitoring. Just visit simplisafe.com/TCAT. That's simplisafe.com/TCATT. There's no safe like SimpliSafe. True Crime All the Time is sponsored by BetterHelp. I want to ask everybody one question. How is your social battery right now? Does it have a ton of energy or are you drained? And why is it at that level? You know, it can be easy to ignore our social battery and spread ourselves thin. What's the right amount of socializing for you and how do you recharge? You know, maybe you're the type of person who thrives around people or maybe you need some more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. I think therapy is a very powerful tool for learning positive coping skills and helping to empower you to be the best version of yourself. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. No more hopping in the car, driving, and sitting in a waiting room. You can do your entire session from the comfort of your own home. All you have to do is fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/TCAT today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/TCATT. So now we're in the mid-90s. Robert Picton's a very wealthy man, but he's not really a pig farmer, right? He doesn't need to run the farm as an operating business anymore. He's kind of treating it as a hobby. You know, he would buy the pigs, he'd fatten them up like you would do on a pig farm, but then he would sell the meat or a lot of times give the meat away to friends or take them over to Piggy's Palace and
roast them up
and make it, you know, part of the festivities or what I call it, other recreational activities.
Yeah, that's what I like.
Whatever was going on. Now, because we talked about so many people going to Piggy's Palace, this means that there was a lot of people feeding on the pigs that were raised by Robert Picton. That's going to come into play pretty big time later on. And it wasn't just the people at Piggy's Palace. So Robert would take the unusable parts of the pig to this place called West Coast Reduction. And this is in Vancouver's East Side. And Vancouver's East Side, also known as, help me, Gib.
Low Tracks?
Low Track. This is like almost like the setting for a lot of what is going to take place. But he would take these remains, and we're talking about, you know, entrails, the brains, bone, just basically everything that was left over after they had probably roasted the pig and, you know, had
even when he slaughtered them, right? Whatever was left.
Yeah, just whatever. The parts that nobody wanted to eat or you couldn't do anything with.
Take them there and let them boil them up.
And that's exactly what West Coast Reduction did. It was a rendering plant. Mm-hmm. So they would use that. But it's around this time, Gibbs, that women began to go missing in, I don't know, astronomical numbers in Vancouver's East Side.
Downtown East Side is probably the biggest concentration of human misery that exists in the developed world. I mean, there's nothing like it anywhere else in terms of the numbers of people that are down and out and never coming back. People are forced to support themselves through selling drugs, selling their bodies, stealing.
So get with your travel agent today.
book a plane to Vancouver and
to the low track,
make a hotel reservation for the east side.
Wow. Yeah.
I don't know if it's like that still today. I don't know how old that clip was, but
I think there's probably places that people would rather not go to.
Yeah. That. I have to believe that that can't be the worst place in the, in the civilized world.
Hopefully some of our Canadian listeners will shine a little light on that and let us know how bad that really is.
Well, and I'm hoping none of them are listening to this in the east side.
Yeah.
We just said you live in the worst place imaginable.
If you do, you know Mike's email.
Yeah. But, you know, it was described as by far the poorest neighborhood in all of Canada, really.
It was.
It was a slum. So there was definitely a lot of drug usage in low track. And because of that, so you got heroin, cocaine, you've got all the usual stuff, but you've got a lot of female addicts roaming around this area of Vancouver's east side. And because of that, you're going to have what you're always going to have when you have a lot of drug addiction.
Prostitution.
So you've got a lot of prostitutes going up and down the streets night and day. And this is going to play in big time to the Robert Picton story. Now, as we said, women are starting to go missing. And a lot of women. I mean, we're talking numbers that in any town here would just be off the charts alarming. But police weren't really all that worried. You know, there was a lot of, and I think it was because of the what they perceived as the type of women that were going missing.
Yeah, they probably just thought, well, she probably ran away to another city, or she's, I don't know how much weight they put behind or how much they cared. Is that really the way to say it, that it was a prostitute? I don't think it was, like you said, I don't think it was on top of their concerns.
Yeah, I would agree, because now, you know, the one thing we haven't mentioned is how close this is to Seattle. A couple hours, I think.
Yeah, I'm trying to remember last time I was there, but yeah.
Yeah, I think it's fairly close to Seattle. But to your point, I had a hard time figuring out, was it the Vancouver PD that just didn't care that these women were missing because they were prostitutes and drug users? Or was it because it's so tough to kind of keep track of transient people like that? Yeah, they move from place to place. And
I think it's the latter.
You do?
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of people think it's the first one.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean,
there's a lot of people that think Vancouver really, or PD, let's say,
right,
really dropped the ball on this investigation. Mm. And maybe we'll have a different opinion as we go through all the facts, but you know, you have to think there's no body showing up, right? It's not like there's a pile of bodies. There's no bodies. They're just,
well, that's why I think
missing women.
Yeah. That's why I think they just figured they were moving on to another city, or, you know, decided to get out of that area, versus, because if there was bodies, then I could see the concern ramping up on the, you know, are the police doing everything they need to be doing to find some of these missing women? Because we're starting to find bodies.
Yeah, no doubt if there's bodies, that changes things, I think, a lot. But either way, regardless, what this does is it creates an atmosphere where a killer can basically operate with very little interference, right? If the police department is not putting that much energy into solving what they know is a situation where all these women are going missing, then you've got kind of a perfect breeding ground or perfect storm for a killer of that type.
So the one place he fit in was at Low Track, where he was kind of like the king, because when he had money, he could buy the drugs. Right, he could get the drugs for the girls that made them happy. He had plenty of food. He can bring them back to his place. They loved it because they could eat. I mean, he would buy the alcohol for them, you know, at the bars in at the Low Track. So, I mean, he was everybody's best friend. I mean, of course, they were using him because he was so generous.
Well, and ultimately, we know that he would be using them as well.
Well, sure, yeah, but...
But I think you're right, because he's got the resources to buy affection.
And he does it really well.
Right. I mean, I think he had an affinity for prostitutes. I don't think there's any doubt about that. You know, he was like the king of low track because here's a millionaire in an area of squalor.
And he had what they wanted.
Yeah. Money.
Money.
Was able to buy or get them whatever they wanted.
As long as you hung out with him, you got your drugs and you got your alcohol.
All right, Gibbs. So let's jump into known victims. Now, there are a lot of potential victims out there when you do the research, but these are known victims where evidence ultimately links them to Robert Picton. And when you really think of August 1997 was probably one of the worst months. There's three women go missing, but the police don't really know about these women for over a year. So you've got Marnie Frey. She was 25, was not reported missing until September of 98. So that's more than a year.
Before someone noticed she was gone.
Right.
That tells you about the low track.
It does. But I also have tape of her parents that will play. So, I mean, she had family. They obviously didn't know where she was, or they weren't able to keep track of her, which is not unusual when somebody's in that type of situation of either using drugs or, and I don't know that she was doing any of this stuff. I'm just saying if she's in the low track, you know, there was a better than not chance that maybe something was going on. So then you have 32-year-old Helen Hallmark and then Jacqueline Murdoch. She's 28. She's reported missing on October 3rd, 1998. But again, all these women are kind of coming up around the same time, missing, even though they've been missing for quite a while. They're just now figuring it out. But detectives have no idea what's going on. They don't really know when they've vanished or from where they vanished. You've got 33-year-old Cindy Beck. She kind of just dropped out of sight completely in September of 97. But again, her disappearance was not reported until April of 98. I mean, all in all, police would come out and say that in 97 alone, there was nine women that they can link missing. But they have no evidence. One of them, 52-year-old Maria Laliberte, she was last seen in low track on New Year's Day. And then you've got Cindy Felix. You've got Sherry Irving. Police had no idea where they were, where they'd last been. They just knew that they couldn't find any of these women.
Should be alarming to anybody.
I think it was, but again, back to your point.
So transient, so...
So, yeah. I mean, and again, we don't know. I don't know if all these people were drug users. I don't know if they were all prostitutes. But when you're living that kind of lifestyle and, you know, were they in the low track all the time? Were they moving around? You know, I just don't know. But it's hard to keep track of. When you have no known address, hard to keep track of somebody.
Yeah. There's no door to go knock on to see if you're home.
Right. No, what do they call it? Like no welfare check.
Yeah.
To go see if somebody's okay. Now there was an exception. There was a 39-year-old woman named Carrie Kosky, and she was different. She was popular, and I don't think she was living maybe the same kind of lifestyle as some of the others. But again, she disappeared in January of 98 and was reported the same month. That tells you something, at least. Somebody noticed much quicker than a year that she was gone. But as we talked about, Gibbs, at this point, there's a lot of women going missing. I don't think that Vancouver PD is spending much energy on this case yet. But then you've got, you know, Jacqueline McDonald goes missing. She's 23. Inga Hall, 46. Last seen in February of 93. 29-year-old Sarah Jane DeVry, April 14th of 98. That was the last time she was seen. And then you had Sheila Egan, who was a known prostitute and had been for quite a while. She vanished at the age of 20 in July of 98. So all these women are missing. And the Vancouver PD really kicks off what I would call the official search in September of 1998. And really the only reason that they even do this is because there was an Aboriginal group that had sent police a list of all the known women that had gone missing in Vancouver's East Side. And they demanded that an investigation be done.
So it was definitely on some people's radar.
Right. Yeah, just not the police.
Not on the police.
That's my takeaway from
it. But now it's on the police radar.
It is, because I think they were shamed into it or forced into it by people saying, hey, these women are missing. You're not doing your job. You know, get to it. So there's four prostitutes that go missing, Gibbs, just while the task force is getting formed. I mean, that's the kind of gravity, right, that we're talking about.
I mean, you get, what, Julie Young, she's 31. She shows up missing now.
Yeah, Angela Jardine. Now, I've said she was a 20-year-old drug addict with a very, very low mental capacity, that of maybe a 10-year-old, that low. And she'd been working the low track for, you know, a long time. Michelle Gurney was 30. She disappeared just a few days before Christmas. You've got Marcella Creason. She got out of jail December 27th of 98. Now, keep in mind, this is all 97, 98. I mean, exactly. How many names have we rattled off?
Too many.
So Marcella gets out of jail, never makes it back to her apartment from jail.
Wow.
She disappears from getting out of jail on the way back to her apartment. In 99, this is when police received their first tip about Robert Picton. And the tip is that he has a freezer filled with human flesh on his farm. So the police go out, as you would, to interview Picton. They even got his own consent to search his farm, but they don't do it. So again, going back to why there's so many people that are adamant about the police not doing their job, we know there's a lot more women going to go missing, right? The number is very high. Could they have stopped it right then and there in 99? But the girls just keep on going missing. So Wendy Crawford, Jennifer Firminger, Georgina Pappen, they all disappear in 99. Basically, there's just not much going on until police start listing all of their names in March of 2000. Detectives acknowledge the disappearance of 32-year-old Brenda Wolf in April of 2000, but they say she actually disappeared in February of 99. So again, I think the police are involved at this point, or at least they're...
Well, I think you're right. I mean, they're getting more involved.
Yeah.
They're taking it seriously now. So
they're
engaged.
Yes, they're engaged. That's the word I'm looking for. That's why I keep you around. So Tiffany Drew, she's 27. She goes missing on December 31st, 99, one day before Y2K. You know, I always have to get a Y2K reference. Dawn Cray, 42 years old. She's the next one to go missing. She's last seen on November 1st, 2000 and reported December 11th. So compared to a lot of these women, that's much, much quicker. 43-year-old Deborah Lynn Jones. She goes missing on the 21st of December, 2000.
So he's actually moving up in the age bracket, too.
Yeah.
Early on, he was definitely in the 20s. So now he's moved up somewhat in the age group.
Yeah, that's another thing. I think I had not really noticed that. So you've got Yvonne Bone, Heather Bottomley. She's 24. So now he's going back down. Now, they held off on Heather Bottomley because she was listed as a violent suicide risk. Heather Shinnock disappeared in April, followed by Angela Josberry in June and Serena Abbotsway in July. So a lot kind of right back to back to back right there. 34-year-old Diane Rock, she went missing in October of 2001. And then the last one we have to talk about is Mona Wilson. She was 26, last seen alive on November 23rd, 2001.
It's a lot of names. It's a lot of victims.
In a very
short period of time,
no doubt. So I think it's at this time where the Vancouver police, they're trying to figure out, obviously, what's happening to all these women. They're starting to think sexual predator. It was really in 99 that an inspector named Kim Rosmo, I think, was probably one of the first ones to say that he believed that this was the work of a serial killer. But again, back then, the police department dismissed the theory altogether.
He loved every bit of it. The pickup, the courtship on the street corner downtown, how much he'd pay, the killing, the dismembering. I think it was just a process he really enjoyed.
Serial killers generally need a bigger and bigger thrill, and so they escalate their violence. When you see that with Willie, you see that he went from going to have sex with prostitutes to bringing them to his home, to raping someone, to killing.
She called him Willie.
Willie.
Willie. But obviously, that clip gets to the heart of the matter. All these women are missing. We know that it's Robert Picton.
Mm-hmm.
We know he's targeting prostitutes. In a large majority, and maybe all of them, he's somehow getting them back to his house, killing them, dismembering them, and in many cases, Gibbs, he's feeding them to his pigs. My wife and I, we both use Rakuten when we shop online to help save money. My wife uses it more than I do because, well, let's face it, she shops more than I do. Rakuten is the most rewarding way to shop and save because members earn cash back on everything that they buy. Rakuten is a shopping platform that partners with over 3,500 stores across every category. You're already shopping at your favorite stores. Why not save while doing it? It really is a no-brainer. I use it for all my techie stuff at stores like Best Buy. My wife uses it at stores like Sephora and Macy. Best of all, membership is free and it's easy to sign up. It's very easy to use. Cashback rates change daily. So start all your shopping at Rakuten.com or get the Rakuten app to start saving today. Your cash back really adds up.
This episode is brought to you by June's Journey. Unleash your inner sleuth and step into the glamorous 1920s. Uncover scandalous family secrets and solve the mysterious murder of June Parker's sister. With dazzling hidden object scenes and riveting storylines in each chapter, June's Journey invites you to a thrilling era of mystery and romance. And now, June needs your help, detective. Download June's Journey for free today on iOS and Android. Your adventure awaits.
All right, Gibbs. So we got to jump forward to a guy named Bill Hiscox. He's 37 years old. And he had worked at a salvage yard that was owned by Robert Picton and his brother David. So they owned it together. Now, the thing about it was that Hiscox would have to go to the pig farm to pick up his paychecks. And he was out there quite a bit. And he started noticing a couple of things. He was seeing that there were a lot of women out there. presumably prostitutes from the low track.
Right.
And he had also, I think, seen some weapons and other things. Well, at some point, you know, and he describes this pig farm as just a crazy looking place. And I think at one point he says there's some big 600 pound boar that's like patrolling the perimeter, you know, crazy stuff like that. But he tells the police. Now, the police were very aware of the Picton brothers. You know, David had been convicted of a sexual assault in 92. His victim had said that David had attacked her in his trailer at the pig farm, but she got away. Now, Robert had had even more serious charges filed against him. In 97, he was charged with attempted murder of a prostitute named Wendy Eistetter. He stabbed her multiple times out at the pig farm. And again, this is where people say, how could they not have known before they did, before this Bill Hiscox comes along and says, hey, you need to go look at these guys.
Right. What happened at that time when they were investigating, you know, the attempted murder?
Yeah. So basically, Eistetter ends up telling the police that Picton handcuffed her, attacked her, but that she escaped after disarming him and ended up stabbing him with his own knife. And a passing motorist found her on the highway about 1:45 and took her to the emergency room. The crazy part is that Picton had to go to the same exact hospital for the stab wound that he got. So their attacker and attackee are in the same hospital.
They're in the same emergency room, huh?
Being treated for the same type of stab wounds. But again, I go back to, you know, the police had investigated him a number of times. You know, we talked about the 99 incident where somebody said there was either body parts or human something in a freezer.
Right.
They chose not to move forward with it.
They didn't pursue it very well.
And I think that's why there's so many people that think they completely bungled this investigation.
I think he got sloppy. I think he got careless. Here's a man who may not have really understood the implications of what could happen to him.
I think he thought he was sort of invulnerable. Again, going back to his mother, his mother got away with murder, and I think he felt sort of invincible. Perhaps this particular woman tried to fight back or did something that was outside the script that Willie had in his mind, and that somehow it must have set off whatever psychological rage that he had.
Again, she calls him Willie.
Willie.
But there, you know, she's talking about Eistetter there and the confrontation or the attack on her. So rolling off of the Bill Hiscox talk with police, on February 5th, 2002, the police execute a search warrant for illegal firearms at Picton's property. He's taken into custody. But they also obtain another court order to search the farm as part of the investigation into all these missing women.
Well, I think that's because while they're at the farm with the search warrant for the weapons, they come across some purses, some of the female's identification, some female clothing. So at that point, they go back and get the upgraded or the additional search warrant.
One of the big things they found was a prescription asthma inhaler. And, you know, obviously that's tying something to somebody.
Yeah, somebody's personal puffer.
Right. But I'm sure they could figure out who that belonged to. So they seal the farm off. They go ahead and they charge Picton with the illegal firearms charges. But that's all they charge him with, and he's released and kept under police surveillance. But he's not out for very long, because February 22nd, they arrest him, and they charge him with 2 counts of first-degree murder in the deaths of Serena Abbotsway and Mona Wilson.
...of a police interrogation, but Picton stopped short of a complete confession. The 11-hour interview shows Picton saying that he had one more apparent killing in mind, but it didn't happen because he says he got sloppy.
What I want you to do, Rob?
Rob is Robert Willie Picton, slumped in his chair looking bored with the proceedings as the police officer tried to get him to talk hours after he was arrested.
What girls that you remember have ever been out to your place?
In the early hours, as Picton is shown photos of the women, he insists he knows nothing.
I don't know. There's so many people coming in and out of my place, I don't know.
With each picture, there's nary a glimmer of recognition.
Has she ever been to your place? Her name's Mona.
She's pretty.
This criminologist says the tape is chilling, but nothing about it is surprising.
He just looked upon this as a number. So totally depersonalized, so totally detached, so totally insensitive, so totally unempathetic, classic psychopathic personality.
So totally.
Absolutely.
So the one thing, Gibbs, that if you listen to that interrogation, and I know the audio is a little tough to hear, but at one point they're asking Robert Picton to look at, you know, all these pictures on a big board of all these missing women. And the detective asks him about one in particular. And I don't know if you heard it, but all he says is, "She's pretty." That's all I can say.
He was cold. But to me, I think we go back to how his mom treated the boy that she rolled into the ditch. I think he treated these women just like they were animals to him. He had a little fun with them, and then when he's done, he put them down because he didn't want to have to deal with them. And it was like no big deal.
It's a stark contrast to you go back to the 12-year-old Robert Picton, who's broken up by his dad slaughtering the calf. And we talked about that. You know, was that one of the catalysts for basically turning off the emotion? Because I think at some point he becomes emotionless.
So that's the magic word right there, right? He's emotionless.
Yeah, he's motionless. He has no empathy. You know, he's showing all these kind of classic traits, but he wasn't always like that. We know that.
Yep.
He loved this little calf and was just devastated, heartbroken, because he cared for it. But between that and some of the stuff his mom did, it's almost like it shut that off, that part of him off.
And it had to, I mean, right? Because it was no difference than if he had that pig up on the hook versus one of the women up on the hook, skinning and butchering. I mean, to him, it was the same thing.
So police are searching the pig farm. You know, they're looking for all kinds of evidence. This search would go on for almost 2 years. They're looking at in the trailers, the buildings, they're even sifting through dirt. They're basically looking for any body parts because they know at this point. So they even flew in forensic experts to determine whether what they were finding was human or pig. Because you got to figure in this pig farm, a lot of dead pig parts too, probably. So by the time all the searching had concluded, they had thousands of samples of human DNA. So separate out all the pig-related stuff they found. Thousands of samples of human DNA.
You can see her brain. You can see her hair. You can see the bisected human head and floating in this pinkish soup. The police investigators made a grid of the entire property, and they were searching it grid box by grid box. There were some freezers in there. One of the freezers contained two buckets, with each containing the head and hands of and feet of Serena Abbotsway and Andrea Josbury.
They took literally hundreds and hundreds of thousands of DNA samples. It was just a mind-boggling police operation. Just a forensic search that probably is unrivaled almost anywhere.
That was an interesting tape, right? Soundbite. And it always seems like, so these killers, they go through every effort to stay clean of the crime. And then as they get more confident, they get sloppy. Here we hear that he's keeping heads, feet, hands in a bucket on the property in a freezer. As what? Is this something he goes back at and looks at later as a trophy? So what was he doing by keeping the head, the hands, the feet in a bucket? I mean, was he coming back to him and pull him out of the freezer to look at him as a trophy, as a let me relive the butchering or the... I don't understand. But why did he do that? Because up to this point, he was doing pretty good from what we understand. He would butcher him, feed the flesh to the pigs, the hogs, whatever, right? And then the remaining parts he would put in the barrel along with the... mix it up with the pig leftovers and haul it off to the rendering farm to be melted down.
Yeah, but... and you and I have done, you know, how many episodes... and it's that's a very common theme. People are very careful when they start out. And then it's like, oh, I got away with that. And I got away with it again. And I continued to get away with it for a certain number of times. And then all of a sudden I get lax.
It's like he feels he's invincible.
No, I think you're right. I think they even one of the ladies might have said it on a previous clip that, you know, whether you call it getting cocky, getting whatever, he felt like, I think invincible is a good word. He felt like he could do whatever he wanted. Nobody was going to catch him because he'd gotten away with everything he'd done to that point. So we know Picton was charged with two counts, right, so far of first degree murder. And it was said, Gibbs, that he was shocked by the charges. Couldn't believe it. Even though mounting evidence is coming out all around him. But I think what this did, and we've kind of touched on it a little bit, you know, the relatives of the victims, you know, they start to come forward. And this is where everybody starts to realize that these women vanished years and years after the first identification of the Piggy Palace as a potential murder scene. It just goes back to what I was saying of, and what I think a lot of people believe is that they could have shut him down way, way earlier than they did.
And we know that when they had the original search warrant.
All they had to do was follow through.
Yeah, they didn't really act on it. So who knows what or how many people they could have saved if they would have.
Yeah, I would just love to know the reason behind the decision of, after already having his consent to search, they make the decision, nah, we're good. Knowing everything they knew back then, even.
So was he so confident back then that he didn't think they would find anything? Or maybe that was his way of, yeah, look, and he'd... who knows?
It could have been either one. I don't know. But what happens is, after he's arrested, there's a lot of people that start coming forward telling the police more about what was going on at the farm, you know, during these years. One of the people that comes forward is a woman named Lynn Ellingson.
Now, she was more of a friend to him. They would hang out together. This is when he, you know, we talked about how they can flip a switch. He had a tendency to be really nice and sweet to some of these women. And then when he got them back to the trailer, something flipped on him and he, you know, would strike, would beat them and then eventually kill them and so forth. But with her, he never felt that way. So she came over, they had whatever they were going to do, right? And then she fell asleep and he went out to the butcher barn where the pigs would be if he was going to butcher up something that night. Well, she wakes up, she hears the noise going on out there. And so she gets dressed and walks out there and she starts to open up one of the doors. And on the meat hook, she sees a woman hanging and he's sharpening up his different butchering tools to get ready to skin and butcher this woman. So she screams, runs off. He doesn't pursue her, either because he didn't hear her scream or because, and it was really said because of his feelings towards her, that whatever reason, he didn't want to hurt her. So she ran off, and at that time, because she was so scared, she never reported it. It wasn't until now that she comes forward because she feels safe that she says, this is what I seen that night.
There was a part of him that didn't care, the same way his mother didn't care that he had feelings.
He put his legs up over the edge of the chair, and he was having a good time. They decided to put an undercover police officer in the cell with Willie to see if he said anything.
At one point, Willie told the undercover cop that he was going for an even 50, which in Willie's mind meant that he had killed 49 women.
So I think that is one of the very interesting part, Gibbs, is setting up this undercover officer in the cell with Robert Picton. And if you go online, I mean, there is video. It goes on for a long time. The problem is you can't hear any of it. You can find the transcript. You just can't understand a word they're saying.
But what I found interesting about that was, so the whole time he's in the jail cell with the undercover cop, right? He's got this plate of, looks like pork and beans.
Yeah, he's eating.
He's eating the heck out of it. And he's scraping the styrofoam plate, trying to get every bit of the sauce. And he's talking about how basically he killed these women and he was so good at it.
Yeah, he has no problem telling.
Yeah.
But I also think that's a hallmark. These kind of people, especially once they're caught, and even sometimes before, but especially once they're caught, they want everybody to know what they've done. And they want to let them know how good they were at it.
And he did. I mean, he was really proud about telling the undercover cop about how he would take some of the remains and take them off to the rendering plant.
Well, and I think that's where the 49 number comes from, right? He basically says, I was one shy of 50.
He even boasted about how he thought that he would have the record over what the states had, meaning that he would have killed more women than the top serial killer in the United States at that time.
Yeah, I think he thought he would be the most prolific serial killer. And to the point, and I think it was, we talked about it in the beginning in one of the clips, he had number 50 picked out before they nabbed him. So he was not going to stop, right? He was going to go and go and go and see how high he could get that number.
And remember, I just find it so weird. I mean, he's telling this story very calm while he's eating a plate of pork and beans. It just was really macabre.
So on March 8th, investigators came out and said that DNA recovered from the farm had been conclusively identified as Abbott's Ways. A month later, they charged Picton with three more counts of murders for Jacqueline McDonald, Heather Bottomley, and Diane Rock. A sixth murder charge for Angela Josberry came 6 days later. And again, part of the uproar here, Gibbs, is these women were all murdered after Bill Hiscox, which we talked about, had told the police about Picton. And again, that's part of the uproar that comes out. You know, if the police know about him, what are they doing? And how did they allow more women to be murdered after they got such a good lead, such a good tip? They added a seventh first-degree murder charge on May 22nd when they found the remains of Brenda Wolf on the pig farm. So on September 20th, 2002, they added four more charges for Georgina Pappin, Patricia Johnson, Helen Hallmark, and Jennifer Furminger. Now remember, I mean, these are all women that we mentioned early on that had gone missing from the low track.
four more charges are added for Heather Chinnock, Tanya Holick, Sherry Irving, Inga Hall. These come down a month later in October. But this brings the total number to 15. And at this point already, it makes this investigation the largest of any serial killer in Canadian history. So they're still doing excavations out at the farm all the way up to November of 2003. And it was said that the cost of this entire investigation was probably somewhere over the $70 million mark.
I could believe that with all the moving the dirt around and just the time. And
well, yeah, how many people does it take to sift through all the dirt and the bones and...
And all the analysis that has to be done.
Lab work, you have to count all that in as well. So, all, you know, a couple of years later, they add 12 more charges on. Because now they've identified Kara Ellis, Andrea Borhaven, Deborah Lynn, Jones, Marnie Frey, Tiffany Drew, Carrie Koski, Sarah DeVries, Cynthia Felix, Angela Jardine, Wendy Crawford, Diana Melnick, and a Jane Doe. So they have one identified woman. But this brings the total number of first-degree murder charges to 27.
It's about time. I think the public needs to know exactly what happened and what we've gone through.
They're still calling for a public inquiry into how police, who were aware of Picton as far back as the mid-90s, couldn't arrest him until 2002.
But damn it, you know, they knew about this clown in 1998, and so did some of their other people. Like Kim Rossbow knew about it. And what did they do with him? They gave him the golden handshake and said goodbye. I mean, this is a crock.
Meantime, the Frey say these details are only the beginning of what the public will learn.
Well, I think they are going to be horrified, and that's why I didn't like the media ban to start with. I think if the public should know what's going on.
So that was the dad of Marnie Frey speaking out to the media. So Gibbs, on March 10th, 2004, very disturbing because it's revealed that human flesh may have been ground up and mixed with pork from the farm. So this is in addition to the fact that we know he fed some of the bodies directly to the pigs. But now they've come to the conclusion that he's taken human flesh, meat, pig meat, and mixed them together.
Made a nice little blend, huh?
Yeah. That's very disturbing.
So somebody somewhere could have had a human pork.
Well, we'll get into that
okay.
a little bit later on. But ultimately, you know, police would come out and say that they found evidence of 30 different victims at the pig farm. So again, that number of 49 is not outrageous by any means. I mean, the number 30, they link directly through DNA.
I mean, the fact that they can find 30, I mean, you've got to know that there's a handful that they're just not going to find.
Right.
I mean, that makes sense.
No doubt about
it. The fact that they can even find 30 is amazing to me.
So let's jump forward into the trial. And Picton's trial starts on January 30th, 2006. He pleads not guilty to all 27 charges. Now, the first phase of the trial takes almost a year where they're just trying to determine what evidence is going to be admitted before the jury. That's a long time.
That is a long time.
But they got a lot of evidence. And to me, the fact that, you know, well, I guess it's not crazy that he would plead not guilty, but there's so much evidence against him. Pretty early on, the judge rejects one of the counts because he says there's not enough evidence. So that leaves 26. You know, we have to say, Gibbs, we're used to law and trial here in the States. It is a little bit different in Canada, and we're going to see that as the trial kind of moves through, and definitely in sentencing. Sentencing is way different in Canada than it is here in the U.S. One thing that the judge does is he splits up the counts. So it's like he has one charge of 6 counts and then another group that includes 20 counts. And they move forward on this 6 count group in the first trial. They ultimately never get to the second one, the 20 counts.
Well, I'm just thinking maybe they package it up to say, this is our best case is to take these 6 counts here. Because at the end of the day, we don't need all of this to get the final verdict, right? If we go out for all 30, or if we go out for 6, or whatever the number is, it doesn't matter. As long as we package it right with the best evidence, with the best way that we could win this, maybe that's what they do there.
No, I think you're right, because the judge does go on to explain that trying to do all 26 counts at one time would be too much for a jury, and it would cause the trial to go on for such an extended period of time. But what it would do is maybe increase the chance for a mistrial. And he also says that the 6 counts that were chosen, and maybe this goes to your point, had materially different evidence from the other 20. So I think that's what, I think he's saying what you're saying, which is these 6 are slam dunks. We've got evidence on these other 20. Why include them when we can wrap up the 6 and not endanger the trial, not increase our chance for a mistrial and stuff like that?
And why spend more taxpayer money by going the distance?
They already spent $70 million just...
Yeah, so why spend $2 million more if we don't have to?
In the investigation. So the 6 that were chosen were Marnie Frey, Serena Abbotsway, Georgina Pappen, Andrea Josberry, Brenda Wolf, and Mona Wilson. And I just want to talk a little bit about some of the evidence that was presented to the court. So they found some skulls that were cut in half with hands and feet stuffed inside the hollowed out skull. They found the remains of a victim stuffed in a garbage bag at the bottom of a trash can. All of her bloodstained clothing was found in the trailer. So that all tied together. They found part of a victim's jawbone and teeth. And then they found maybe one of the crazier things they found was a loaded .22 revolver with a big spiky black handmade dildo over the barrel. And one round had been fired out of the gun through the dildo, which I assume acted as a silencer. But the dildo had Picton's DNA on it, and it had the victim's DNA on it.
Wow.
Well, yeah, it's not much to say on that one, is there?
Yeah, I'll leave it at that.
Is wow. Now, they found that in his laundry room, so I don't know if he was going to wash it or... get it ready to be used at a later date. I'm not sure why he had it in his laundry room.
So just think about this, Mike. This is how sick of a person he was. He took the time to take the head over to a bandsaw and precision cut it in half so he can do what he wanted. That's just...
So he could put other body parts inside of it like a bowl.
Yeah. I don't know. I'm sorry. That's just how sick this guy was.
Well, I think he had a lot of time on his hands.
Yeah.
He was a millionaire, retired pig farmer. What else did he have to do?
I know.
They found night vision goggles. They found some Spanish fly.
Oh, the old Spanish fly.
The old Spanish fly, which I thought was a myth, but maybe that's real. They found a syringe that had some blue liquid inside.
What was that?
Well, it would come out later because they would come out same time. But what they also found a videotape of one of Picton's friends. And I can't imagine he had too many. But basically, the video was Robert Picton telling his friend that a good way to kill a female heroin addict was to inject her with windshield washer fluid. So my assumption is the blue liquid in the syringe was... Windshield washer fluid.
Washer fluid, yeah.
There was another tape in which an associate of Picton's said that Picton mentioned killing prostitutes by handcuffing them, strangling them, then bleeding and gutting them before feeding them to the pigs.
And this is critical because this associate actually tells this to the jury during the trial. And even though the defense tries to discredit him by saying he has a criminal record and miscellaneous stuff, but the way he tells it, it's so compelling that the jury, they can't forget it. They remember hearing this.
But no, I think it always is more powerful when you have somebody on the stand firsthand, right? You don't have somebody saying, I heard that so-and-so said this, or you have a person that was with Robert Picton hearing him talk about how he killed these prostitutes. That had to be very, very, very powerful. So there was a little bit of juror misconduct that kind of played a little bit of havoc with the trial, because there was a juror that basically had her mind up from the beginning that Robert Picton was innocent. Now, how she came to that conclusion, I have no idea, because all the evidence that was laid out and the testimony and all of that seems pretty darn overwhelming.
So did she have a fascination with him? Because we know with these serial killers that some reason women or even men get attracted to them. I don't know why that is, but no, we know it happens.
Yeah, but this wasn't that, because ultimately the judge asked her about it and she says that that's not true. So I'm not, you know, somebody had accused her of this, or somehow somebody thought she had her mind made up, but she convinced the judge that she didn't, and the judge allowed her to stay on the jury. It's just kind of a weird thing.
Well, maybe she told the other juries that, in her mind, he's innocent until she hears it all the way to the very end.
That could have been.
Maybe she didn't want to commit to guilty until she heard everything.
Well, and actually, I would hope she would be. I would hope that's how jurors, you know, would act. So on December 9th, 2007, the jury comes back with a verdict that Picton is not guilty on 6 counts of first-degree murder. But they do find him guilty on 6 counts of second-degree murder. But a second-degree murder conviction, you know, it carries a punishment of a life sentence with no possibility of parole for a period between 10 to 25 years.
So you have a life sentence. However, we can look at paroling you in 20 years.
Well, and like I said, that is the big, if you want to look at the big difference between the system here in the United States and the system in Canada, is that their sentences are much lighter from what I've seen. Now, I'm no expert, but people tend to get out much quicker.
I think because he was found guilty, that they should have just put him in a pig pit like they did with Hannibal.
And just see what happens? Let the pigs go at him?
Yeah, just don't feed the pigs for a week and then drop them in.
But the other thing, so this period of parole, anywhere between 10 and 25 years, is set by the trial judge, right? It's not set by law. There's a lot of discretion that the judge has to say what that number is.
So they give a lot of power to the judge?
It appears so.
Okay.
And it's essentially about premeditation. And so you wonder how someone who killed 6 women didn't premeditate that it wasn't planned and orchestrated.
The jury just couldn't reconcile in their mind whether or not he acted alone.
And so you hear that, and some of the stuff gives, I don't know if you read this or not, there was chatter, and I say chatter because it's floating around when you look at message boards and as we get into some of the research that we do, that there was a lot of people that thought his brother David had a role to play. And so I don't know if that's what the guy on the tape meant by the jury couldn't wrap their head around the fact that he did this all by himself. So. All right, Gibbs. So on December 11th, the judge reads 18 different victim impact statements, and he ends up sentencing Picton to life with no possibility of parole for 25 years. So he went the maximum, right? He had the option to go from 10 to 25, and he went the most he could go.
So like in the States, we would call that 25 to life.
Would we?
I think that's what we would call that. Because the earliest he could be out is 25 if the parole board agrees, or he could go life if he doesn't, you know, depending if he has any more parole hearings after that.
Yeah, well, you're right. Because he could come up for parole every so many years and them not never let him out.
Right.
But like I said, I think the difference in Canada is that they tend to let people out much quicker. Because I can rattle off cases, big, big, high-profile cases where people are out right now walking the streets.
That have killed
multiple people.
I think there would be a big uproar. Maybe I'm wrong, but
here?
I mean, no.
Or there?
Even there.
No, so there. I think there is uproar from a lot of people that think that people don't do enough time. Now, there's many Canadians that totally agree with it. I don't know.
I just can't see how you could let somebody like that out of prison.
Ever. I mean, he's not going to be rehabilitated.
No.
In 25 years.
I don't even know how old he'd be.
I don't care if he's 80 years old. He's going to come out.
Yeah.
Get a prostitute. Kill her.
Right.
Find a pig.
Grind him up. I was actually surprised that he hasn't been murdered in prison.
Well, we just talked about Donald Harvey was killed just, you know, a couple weeks ago.
That's some good prison cred.
Yeah. Guy beating to death in his cell. So on August 4th, 2010, prosecutors basically come out and say they're not going to pursue the final 20 murder charges, basically ending any prospect of that they'll ever go to trial. I do want to talk about this one guy named Pat Casanova. And he was a friend of Robert Picton's, and he was a witness at the trial. And apparently he was arrested during the investigation. You know, he butchered pigs on the Picton farm, and he admitted to having received oral sex from one of the victims, Andrea Josberry, in Picton's trailer. It was likely that he was probably the last person to ever see her alive. And the only reason I bring it up is because I think he had a lot of knowledge of what was going on there, right? He admitted to having seen around Picton's trailer a lot of items of women's clothing, purses, but he never asked Robert Picton about any of this. He was tripped up a couple of times during the trial in some of his answers where he gave conflicting testimony about some of the prostitutes out at the farm. So I'm not saying that this guy killed anybody by any stretch. It just seemed like he had a lot of knowledge.
That he might have known more than he let on.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think there's a good chance of that. But he's never been charged in anything. I just bring it up because I thought it was interesting.
It is interesting.
So, you know, as we're winding down, right, a lot of information in this Robert Picton case. But we get to what is probably one of the most disturbing parts, other than obviously a bunch of people lost their lives, and that's horrible.
Right. Definitely feel for the families.
Yeah, we definitely do. We always feel for the victims. But then you have what comes out later, and that is about people that may have eaten this concoction that we talked about earlier. Combination of some of the victims and some of the pig meat. And I think at first they thought it was just maybe some of the guests out at the Piggy's Palace, but they later learned that that was not true because we talked about it, right? Robert Picton gave away all kinds of pig meat to a lot of different people. So the question is, how much of that included some of these 30 victims plus, maybe?
We been given a lot of pig meat from that pig farm. The night that this all broke on the news, we phoned Lynn, and the first thing that my daughter had said to her aunt was, I was really sorry with Auntie Lynn, because it's possible we could have eaten Marnie.
So shocking. A girl calls up the aunt and says, I'm sorry, there's a chance that we may have eaten Marnie, Marnie being Marnie Frey.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, how do you live with that?
I don't know.
You don't know if you did, but you
never
ate.
Know.
You'll never know. And that, again, that's bad. But then later what comes out is, remember we talked about Picton taking all of his unusable pig parts to this rendering place, this mm-hmm. West Coast reduction. And it was later learned that fragments of some of the dead women's bodies may have entered the food chain through that rendering plant. So not only did Picton maybe give it out to various people, but we know what some of the leftover parts are used for.
Hot dogs and bologna.
Yeah. There's a chance that some of that ended up on a shelf somewhere.
In a store near you in Vancouver?
Yeah, if you're listening in Vancouver.
Yeah.
So, I mean, to me, that is, all of it's disturbing, but that part is just flat out crazy. All right, Gibbs, so now that we've spoiled everyone's dinner, and nobody will probably eat hot dogs and bologna for a while.
Except for that one guy. There's a guy out there saying, it doesn't bug me.
Well,
he's probably eating a hot dog right now as he's listening.
As he's listening to the show. But that is the disturbing, macabre, whatever adjective you want to use, story of Robert Picton. And I think it was good to go outside the U.S. a little bit.
Thank you, Canada.
Thank you, Canada.
Thanks for my nightmares for the next week.
But, you know, I think it just shows you, right? There's monsters everywhere.
Yeah, it doesn't matter where
they are. I mean, we're going to do some in Australia. England's got their own. South America.
South America has some of the worst.
Russia's got one of the worst.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we'll go all over. It's just we had kind of focused on the U.S. cases, you know.
And we still will. Here.
Oh, yeah. We'll just sprinkle them in every now and then. I don't want everybody to think we're going to go all Epcot and just go around the world. But every now and then, you know, we sprinkle in because we have listeners all over the world. So for Mike
and Gibby,
stay safe and keep your own time ticking. Tell everybody about a game that I've been playing recently called Two Dots. You know, primarily Two Dots is a puzzle-based game. You have to connect at least two dots of the same color to make a move. And then those connected dots are removed from the game area, and the dots above them drop down until they hit other dots or the floor beneath. But there's a variety of game modes. There's this really cool one called Scavenger Hunt, which is a really relaxing hidden object game. There's different levels to the game that are grouped into worlds, and it's very satisfying to move up. There's over 5,000 unique puzzles and fun levels, and with all the different gameplay modes, it really makes the gaming experience unique and exciting with every single puzzle. The visuals are amazing, and the in-game music I found to be very soothing. You can even challenge your friends on Facebook to make it competitive, link up, and see how your dot skills match up. And best of all, it's free to download, and you don't need Wi-Fi to play it. You can play it offline as well. Think you have what it takes to solve some fun puzzles? Download Two Dots now for free on Android or iOS.